Good morning. Call Senate Judiciary Committee to order. Today is Wednesday, the 15th of March, the Ides of March, Bundy Day. And we have with us this morning, well, it's now about 8:33 a.m., and all members of the committee are present. We're going to start this morning with the continuation of Senate Bill 222. And we have before us for consideration a CS version Sierra. Senator Terrio?
Mr. Chairman, I move the backslash S version as the working document before the committee.
I'll object for purposes of discussion. Senator Guess?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll walk through the changes. Please stop me if you have any questions about them. The first change is page 2, line 2. You heard in some of the testimony from the stakeholders, we wanted to ensure that a notification was only going to those people who had a security breach, and that was the purpose of the bill. It was a little unclear. This is the language that says it's not the entire database, it's just the people impacted. Page 2, lines 12 through 13 was a request of the bankers that we thought was a good one, which says that law enforcement has to tell you in writing when they're lifting a hold on a notification. So there's kind of clear communication between law enforcement and the people that need to do the notifying. You won't see on page 3, right above the definition section, there used to be a minimum contacts section. It wasn't needed, as Department of Law pointed out, so the drafter took it out there and in one other place. Page 3, line 27, another request of a stakeholder to change the definition of breach of security means unauthorized acquisition or reasonable belief of unauthorized acquisition.
Okay, now that's a question that I had there.
Okay.
Simply because on page 2, line 2, was subject to the breach. So if they were subject to the breach, it would have to be this definition of a breach of security with a reasonable belief.
Clicker's not. I'm sorry, page 2, line 2?
Line 2, your first change. Line 2 says to each resident whose personal information was subject to the breach. And so now we're talking about the new expanded definition or of the breach from this point.
Correct.
Because otherwise the word subject to might give me some concern if we didn't have it defined fairly
yes.
carefully.
Yes, and this okay. is the definition. All goes back to this definition.
All right, go ahead.
Okay. Page 4, lines 7 through 21 is a whole new section regarding the insurance industry. That's the next one. This is the redefinition of personal information. The last definition of personal information had a section B that was a little bit nebulous and made people feel nervous because it didn't really say exactly what it was. So we clarified that and kind of redefined what personal information is. The biggest changes are on line 8 when we said not encrypted or redacted or is encrypted in the encryption key. Has been accessed or acquired. So we kind of covered those situations. So it's still non-encrypted data unless someone accesses, that someone accesses the encryption key as well. And then on line 10, you'll see an individual's name, address, or telephone number along with any of these pieces of information. The reason for that is it is so easy, and I can go online, and I've done it before, to do reverse lookups to get a name. If you give me a phone number, I can find out whose phone number that is and find a name back to it, and same with address.
Look in the phone book almost.
Look in the phone book. I mean, it's whitepages.com. You can do a reverse checkup. So that was to clarify those situations and then take away what was in the previous one said, or a combination of any of the ones above, and it wasn't as clear as I think it needed to be, so folks knew when there was going to be, knew what personal information was. So this is a clean, clear list of personal information. Page six, lines 13 through 23. This was at the request of the insurance industry. Before we allowed third parties to have an application be incomplete, most businesses that works. The insurance industry needed some more clarifying language given their regulations. This language has gone through the Division of Insurance as well. And this was language that everyone agreed on. To try to do the exact same thing we had done on lines 10 through 13 for all the other businesses. There's just a feeling that they needed a little bit more language for them. Page 8, kind of the, we haven't rewritten, but the consumers have a right to obtain a security freeze. That notice of rights, there were some words added to it to make sure that it was in sync with the bill. Lines 19, we added credit score and any information. And then we actually deleted a part on the back page, but that was just kind of conforming to the entire bill. We hadn't gone back and looked at that section for a while as we had been making changes. Page 10, right above limited application, another place where minimum contacts was deleted because it wasn't needed. Line 12, or page 12, line 8, just clarifies, and this happened in a couple places in response to stakeholders, to clarify that your credit report and your credit score are frozen. It's kind of clear with credit report. Some people wanted it to be more clear and to put in or credit score. Also on page 12, under Consumer Credit Information Agency, at the request, hold it, 9-8. At the request of the stakeholders that this impacts, we made it, we cleared up the language and we conformed to the California law. It didn't do anything substantially different than our language, but then it was one language for everyone. Page 16, lines 28 to 17, lines 3. There's kind of two. This clarifies that any state agency can adopt regs in this section. It also puts in that you may not ask for an individual to provide the agency with a social security number unless federal, state, or local law especially authorizes. So there are purposes where local law also needs to ask for a social security number. But we are putting the hurdle in that it has to be authorized in law. So there's got to be a statute or a reg to be able to require disclosure of social security number. The part on the top of page 17, the Department of Administration actually doesn't have the authority now to write regulations. And Department of Law asked that we were clear that all state agencies can write regs to implement this section. Then you'll see in the section below that this just ensures the interagency disclosure. Within a business, you can disclose Social Security number. The way agency is defined, you would have had to stay within the Department of Law, within the courts, and there are lots of good reasons why Social Security number needs to be exchanged within interagencies. So this was at the request of the state trying to make them similar to a business and not more restrictive. And then Article 5, kind of all of Article 5. It was requested to make government agencies no different than anyone else, and so they were put into the disposal records section. So then we were consistent with the bill between businesses and governmental agencies. And those are all the changes in the CS, Mr. Chair.
Questions? Hearing none. I remove my objection. Is there further objection? Hearing none, the CS / Sierra is adopted. Questions on the bill?
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Terrio.
The one thing that Senator Guess and I had not changed in here is there still is the issue of the state agencies being liable. And just in our conversations with the individuals, there seemed like there was the majority of people that we had talked to, and the senators on the Senate side, have indicated that if businesses, you know, get zapped for a disclosure, they didn't want the state agencies to be treated any differently. We know that's you know, likely trigger a fiscal note out of the state agencies, and at this point, we'd like to have that go up to finance, and we can argue about what the legitimate size of the fiscal note is. But we realize at this time that there is going to be a fiscal impact, or there's going to be a fiscal note from the state agencies. We just don't, at this point, see reason to exempt the agencies from the same types of penalties that would accrue to businesses that are handling this sensitive information.
Okay. Was there a finance referral on this, or is it going to be picked up, you think?
It will.
I don't think there was one.
There wasn't one. It will be picked up.
Yeah, it'll be picked up.
Okay. It was observed by the Senate President and wanted to see what we came out of judiciary with before he automatically.
Okay. Let's go to public testimony. First on the list in Anchorage, Steve Clary. Mr. Clary, are you there?
Chair.
Yes, if you'll introduce yourself for the record, where you could hear your testimony this morning.
Mr. Chair, my name is Steve Clary. I'm the director of the Alaska Public Interest Research Group, ACPIRG. We have 1,000 members here in Alaska, and we're the oldest consumer protection advocacy group here in Alaska. I wanted to keep my remarks brief today. I've been talking this bill up a lot. When people ask me how my work is going, I hold this bill up as a great example of bipartisan work in the legislature. And I'm really thankful for the sponsors for this bill. I have a quick anecdote I wanted to share with you about security freezes. A member of our group, who's also the mother of a friend of mine, she accidentally called in an 800 number to try and opt out of some credit card pre-approved solicitation, and she ended up giving her birth date and her social security number into a keypad key-in thing, and then thought that it might be a scam. But when she had those thoughts, she had already shredded the number that she called and didn't know which number it was, and so now she's worried that she and her husband might be the victims of identity theft. They're both close to retirement, have no major purchases coming up, and are really concerned that they may be the victims of identity theft. And I illustrate this example as a good example of who could benefit from a security freeze. They don't need access to new credit, and they are potential victims of identity theft through their own error, and they've gone through now soliciting free credit reports and taking all the steps notifying their financial institutions of this danger, but they would really benefit from being able to put a freeze on their credit report so that potential identity thieves wouldn't be able to open new lines of credit in their name. And I think it's a good example of the importance and the urgency for this bill. And I really want to emphasize that it is going to benefit consumers here in Alaska. And I really thank you for attention to this bill, and I hope that it can move quickly. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions? Seeing none, Mr. Sniffen, are you there, sir?
Yes, Chairman Segan, thank you. My name is Ed Sniffen. I'm an Assistant Attorney General with the Department of Law here in Anchorage, where I work in the Consumer Protection Unit. And I have testified previously on this bill, so I will keep my remarks short. I think Senator Terrio expressed the concern the state continues to have with state liability, but I think those issues can be taken up at a later time. The one comment I wanted to make on the CS, first of all, is to thank Senators Terrio and Senators Gett and their staff for the great work they've been doing on this bill and for working with us to resolve our concerns. That has been a tremendous help. And I think the changes to the section on disclosure and acquisition of Social Security information has gone a long way toward resolving most of the concerns that we have had with the ability of state agencies to perform their functions. There's just one comment I'd like to make on the interagency disclosure section on page 17. The new section that begins at line 4 is section 45.48.415. allows local government agencies to disclose Social Security numbers to other state or local agencies. I have been told by some agencies that they also disclose Social Security information to non-governmental third parties in certain circumstances that aren't necessarily required by federal or state law, but it's necessary in order to accomplish their function. And the example I'm going to give is the Alaska Commission on Post-Secondary Education. They make a lot of student loans every year. When those loans are in default, the agency is required to report those defaults to credit agencies. And the credit bureaus maintain this information by Social Security numbers. So there's really no other way to do this credit reporting other than by using Social Security numbers. And the failure to do this could result in the loss of federal guarantees on more than $50 million in outstanding guaranteed loans that the state currently holds. So there are some isolated circumstances that require state agencies to actually disclose this information to entities other than state or federal agencies. And I don't know that I have a solution to that. I don't know how other states who have passed this kind of legislation deal with those issues as well. I'd like to look into that, and perhaps we could take this up at the next committee hearing as well. So anyway, with those comments, again, thank you to Senators Guest, Terrio, and their staff for their wonderful work on this bill. And if I can answer any questions for anybody, I'd be happy to do so.
Senator Guest.
Yes, thank you, and thank you, Mr. Sniffen. That concern was communicated by Mr. Tibbles, and we actually are working on language and do hope to resolve it, but it wasn't as easy as taking one section and plopping it down in another section. So we are working on that. My apologies, we didn't communicate that back to you. We communicated that to Mr. Tibbles, and we are resolving it, but we have to make sure we resolve it without any other unintended consequences within the bill.
Through the chair. Thank you, Senator Guest. That's terrific. And if I can help you in that regard at all, please let me know.
We will.
And I have some comfort that it's going to get a hearing in finance where other technical amendments that may be necessary will be picked up between now and then as well. Ed, let me ask you a question. You heard Mr. Cleary's story about a person who thinks they may have been tricked by dialing into an 800 number. Wouldn't your agency be able to determine what that 800 number was without too much trouble and investigate something like that?
Chairman Seekins, we could take a look at that, that's for sure. I don't know if it would be without too much trouble, because these numbers are very difficult to track down. We have to subpoena information from phone companies, and it's a costly and time-consuming effort, but it's certainly something we could look into, and we would ask the consumer if they'd like file a complaint with us, and we take a look at these things all the time.
Yeah, because that consumer shouldn't you be able to fairly simply be able to find out all the numbers dialed from that particular phone?
Chairman Deakins, I would think that is the case. Yes.
Yeah, I would think so too. But it's one of those things where, you know, I know your agency is busy, but that is within your purview, isn't it?
Chairman Deakins, yes, it is. Yeah, these things are a concern, and we find these sort of 800 number scams that operate all the time, and we have shut a few of them down. So if the consumer has information about the identity of the person, their name, perhaps an address, talk to, even if she doesn't have the phone number, we may be able to find out who it was.
Yeah, I would. I know several times I've referred people to say, get a hold of Attorney General's office, and they can help you on these things. And I hope Mr. Cleary will give that advice to this particular individual.
Yes, he's shaking his head here like he plans to do that. So thank you very much, Senator Steve.
All right. Thank you for your testimony. Any more questions for Mr. Sniffen? Hearing none, thank you very much, gentlemen. Is there anybody else that wants to testify in this bill today? Anyone else in line? Seeing none, anyone in the audience? There are none. Public testimony is closed. Is there discussion on the bill? Senator French.
Mr. Chairman, I think there's been a lot of great work done on this bill, and it's ready to leave committee. I'm not sure what the rest of the committee thinks, but I'd be willing to make a motion.
Go ahead.
I'd move that CS for Senate Bill number 222 be moved out of this committee onto the next committee referral with the attached or with the to-be-delivered fiscal note and individual recommendations.
Is there objection? Hearing none, this bill is moved on to the Finance Committee pending referral by the President of the Senate. Short recess. We're back on the record. Next on our schedule this morning is Senate Bill 206, and it looks to me like we have a new CS in front of us for consideration today, backslash India. Do I hear a motion? Senator Terrio?
Mr. Chairman, I move the backslash I version as a working document before the committee.
And I'll object for purposes of discussion. Senator?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Committee members, pardon me.
Need to have you introduce yourself to us, even though we know you intimately.
I don't think I'll go there. I think you have a resolution about that. Mr. Chairman, Don Bundy, Senator, District P. Mr. Chairman, just as background, the chief of police in my community and a number of us citizens have been frustrated that in particular, where gang violence has taken place, the rival gangs are perhaps puffed up with themselves, and the police would, would ask to stop and talk to these people at the scene of a crime, and they would, in the vernacular, blow off the cops. They would just leave. And it turns out that we don't have the kind of tool that a police officer would like to use to temporarily detain someone to either defuse the situation or to gather information about the crime. And what we've had been going on in Anchorage, at least, is cases of retribution where the participants in this violent acts are extracting revenge on each other, and rather than, you know, most of vigilante sort of thing, rather than allowing law enforcement to take its proper course. As always, Mr. Chairman, this we have to be careful of when we introduce legislation that affects criminals, that we don't trample on the rights of the ordinary citizen. What the CS before you will do is, I believe, allow a police officer to temporarily detain someone, ask for identification, take their photograph if necessary, and if they are not cooperative in that fashion, then take more serious steps. I believe the chiefs of police, both from your community and mine, have seen this CS and are supportive of it. They think it will be a useful tool, and I think it's been crafted as so that it does not unduly infringe on the rights of the innocent. And as I'm about to exceed my legal depth, then I would ask Mr. Guarnelli to talk about the balance that we've tried to achieve.
Thank you, Senator. Any questions for the senator first? Senator Terrio?
Page 2, lines 26 through 30. I'm just wondering if you want to detain me because I was the witness to a crime, why would you need to take my fingerprints?
This only occurs if there was a murder, attempted murder, misconduct involving a weapon. Again, it's the notion that both sides in these battles are likely to be breaking the law, and in an attempt to defuse the combat and to lead to a successful investigation.
Mr. Guarnelli, did you have? You looked like your body language said you wanted to add something to the.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Dean Guarnelli, Chief Assistant Attorney General for the Criminal Division of the Department of Law. Through the chair, Senator Terrio, I think that it was Chief Monaghan's view expressed to Senator Bundy's office that in the kind of gang-related situations that they find in Anchorage, they also tend to find a lot of false IDs, and certainly with computer systems and able to generate very legitimate-looking identifications. I think it was his view that in these particularly serious cases that the officer shouldn't have to rely on a proffered government ID, that they ought to be able to take a fingerprint for those serious cases. And those would be murder, attempted murder, and just so you know, misconduct involving weapons in the first degree covers two things. It covers uses or possesses a weapon during our most serious drug offenses, basically sale of trafficking in drugs, ordinarily heroin and cocaine and methamphetamine. The second offense covered under misconduct involving weapons in the first degree is drive-by shootings, and it's a Class A felony offense. It was enacted specifically to deal with situations, particularly in Anchorage, of drive-by shooting incidents. So, you know, those are the most serious kinds of offenses that the Anchorage Police Department is investigating. They're the most serious kinds of offenses that the gang organizations get involved in that directly endanger the public. And it was his view that in those limited circumstances that they ought to be able to take that one additional step of getting positive identification of the person, and so that's why that's included.
Senator Terry, go ahead.
But if it's the police gathering up everybody in the parking lot in Anchorage, that, you know, when there was some kind of a gang altercation, that, you know, it's not only the Crips and the Bloods that gets swept up, it's the mom wheeling her groceries out to her car, isn't it? And I just don't see, even if it can be, you know, you can take the impression without unreasonably delaying the person, should they have the right to fingerprint everybody in the parking lot? I've had no reason to have my fingerprints entered into any kind of police database anywhere that I can think of, and I don't know if I just happen to be in the wrong place at the wrong time that my prints should be entered into a database.
Through the chair, that is certainly, I guess that's certainly a policy call that needs to be made. I think the police are in a difficult situation with a large number of people who need to be dealt with right at that time. This does not require the police to take fingerprints, and I think that they would use some judgment if a woman is taking her kids through the parking lot and just, you know, on their way home and shows a driver's license. I can't imagine that they would take the fingerprints. But would they have the right to under this? Sure, they would. I think including some additional conditions, such as the police have reason to believe that the identification may be invalid, may impose on them a burden that is difficult to meet. Another suggestion that in the last week was considered was the police have reason to believe that this is a member of, you know, a gang, as we've tried to define in other bills. I think the police often, you know, a month later they may be able to say, oh yeah, that person was a member of the gang, but right then at that instance, are they able to do that? Not in all cases. So I think there were other considerations trying to impose other conditions, and it just didn't seem as though any of them were particularly workable. So that's why it's as it is.
Senator?
Mr. Chairman, a couple of points. One, just after mention, of course, that through our whole judicial system, we have judgment calls. They're prosecutorial discretion. The police every day make judgment calls as to when an infraction is a big enough deal to make a stop, and even writing the ticket should it be a warning or should it be an actual ticket, that sort of thing. It'd be great if we could write a perfect law and we could get rid of courts, because everything would be decided very clearly, but obviously we can't, and I would suggest that we need to have some confidence in knowing that it would be occasionally abused, but some confidence in the judgment calls of professionals in this arena. The other thing I wanted to mention is that I hope the committee doesn't think that this is special interest legislation for Anchorage only. Unfortunately, I think that we may be a bellwether for what's going to happen in other communities in Alaska. It's a growing trend, and it's an unfortunate fact.
Many of us other committees hope that you're not the bellwether for what will become in the future. No, I'm kidding you.
I'm referring to the gang violence.
I'm kidding you. Mr. Guarnelli, before I have Mr. Have you got your statute book there?
Yes.
Would you tell me what the heading in your book is for 1161-195?
You know, Your Honor, I'm just looking at that, and it actually should have referenced 1161-190.
Correct.
Because 195 is in the second degree, and 190 is the first degree, which it was what was intended. So that was a good catch, Mr. Chairman.
Yep. Senator Terrio?
You want a motion to correct that? I'd move on.
I don't think we've lifted the objection to the CIC.
Haven't lifted the objection yet. Let's wait till we get there. Okay. So we don't forget.
Question then for Mr. Guarnelli on page 2, line 26. Person is detained in connection. So You've got that detained in connection in conjunction with, you can reasonably take the fingerprint without delaying a person. Is just saying, you know, don't leave. I want to get a statement from you because you've witnessed the color of the car screaming out of the parking lot. Is that detained in connection? Is that, I understand it's not required. It allows the police officer, but I guess, isn't there some way of determining if the police officer believes the person was involved in the activity versus, well, I just want to get a statement for them, you know, so they can possibly show up as a witness?
Through the chair, I think, and I, you know, I haven't had an opportunity to go through the bill to the work draft to explain what's here, but going up to subsection A, you know, starting on line, let's say, 3, that gives the standards that police have to meet in order to temporarily detain the person, such that the person witnessed the commission of the crime or was at the scene or in the vicinity during the commission of either crime against a person or a felony-level property crime. Two, the person may have information, material aid in the investigation, and the temporary detention is reasonably necessary to do certain things. Those are the standards that the police have to meet, and all of these go to people who are believed to have information of aid to the police, and it really has nothing to do with them being directly involved, being a suspect in, etc. Because I think the situations faced by the police are that something has happened, a shooting has occurred, there are a large number of people in the area who, you know, they may have been involved peripherally or directly, but certainly the police have reason to believe that they know something material aid to them. And so I think it's very difficult for the police to, again, get a level of information that brings them to the point of saying that someone is suspected in that activity. It's just a difficult hurdle for them to get over.
Thank you.
Senator French.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Three questions. One, maybe just for the record, you could read us all the definitions of misconduct involving a weapon in the first degree so we have a clear idea of what legal settings this statute would apply to.
Certainly, through the chair. First of all, misconduct involving weapons in the first degree.
Mr. Guanella, just so you know, we don't follow the protocol here, but you don't have to answer through the chair in this committee if you have your conversation. And we also ask our senators just to let me know when they're done so that we don't have to. I mean, that makes it a little harder on the clerk, but we've got a good one over here. So.
Okay. Misconduct involving weapons in the first degree is a Class A felony. That means it's a very serious felony offense in Alaska. The presumptive range, I believe, for that conduct is, I think, 5 to 8 years. And it reads, a person commits the crime of misconduct involving weapons in the first degree if the person, one, uses or attempts to use a firearm during the commission of an offense under AS 1171-010-040, and those are the felony-level drug offenses in Alaska. And the primary places where firearms come into play in the felony-level drug offenses are during sales, trafficking in, or using firearms to guard your stash while you're in the business itself. That's subsection A1. A2 then reads, discharges a firearm from a propelled vehicle while the vehicle is being operated, in other words, while it's being driven, and under circumstances manifesting substantial and unjustifiable risk of physical injury to a person or damage to property. And this is, as I mentioned before, this is specifically to deal with drive-by shootings. And that was why that particular provision was enacted a few years ago. Those are the only two
okay.
categories.
Thank you. My next question has to do with page 2, line 9. and I can see the need to, I guess I can see how the police could develop a reasonable suspicion that someone witnessed the commission of a crime and would have a pressing need to speak to that person. But if the situation we're trying to get at is the Diamond Mall parking lot shootout, then line 9 refers to folks who are either at the scene or in the vicinity, who may or may not have had any contact with the crime, may or may not have any information about the crime, may or may not have been in a position to see what happened, may have left the mall after the incident took place and had been going, as Senator Terry points out, to their car when the police arrived. And so it's, I guess I have some concerns about how tightly that's drafted to give the police this power to get at people who are just simply in the vicinity of a drive-by shooting or a murder, or attempted murder.
Senator French, I think that there are, if you think about, you know, a shooting that might take place, there are some people who might be right in the immediate vicinity and have actually observed that. Then the person who commits the shooting often doesn't stick around, and they may get in a car or run off, and there may be people outside the immediate vicinity who may have witnessed the person fleeing, able to identify that person to police. And so I think this subsection A1B is designed to allow the police to talk to the people who may have some additional information but not directly an eyewitness. I think the critical part of this whole provision is that it's not simply that you were in the vicinity that gives the police the opportunity to talk to you. It is, in subsection A2, it's that the police also have to have reasonable suspicion that you may have information of material aid to them. So the determination of this person, you know, should have been in a position of observing the fleeing car. There's got to be some kind of determination like that made before they have the opportunity to do all these things, take photographs, you know, fingerprints, etc. So I think it's 1, 2, and 3 under subsection A that the police have to have reasonable suspicion to in order to make get that information.
I still have some concerns about vicinity, but I guess that really leads to my last question. That is, maybe you could tell the committee what level of force the police are authorized to employ in order to gain the cooperation of citizens who may not want to be photographed or fingerprinted.
Next page. Anytime the police have authority to take action, they have the ability to use a reasonable level of force to enable them to effectuate that action. That is going to depend on the circumstances. And the circumstances in this, in this work draft are that they are not dealing with someone they have reason to believe is a suspect or is involved with the crime. They're dealing with a citizen who may have information, and so therefore the level of force, if you will, and force is defined very broadly in Alaska law to involve really almost anything that involves either laying on of hands or you know, temporarily detaining someone, you know, saying, hey, wait a minute, stop, and restricting their movements even, that is going to, the courts are going to apply the notion of reasonable force with the concept in mind that these are citizens. They may have material aid to an important investigation, but there is certainly a limit to what the police can do. And I don't think I'm in a position to say what that might involve specifically, but I think that the courts are going to be very careful about giving the police broad authority to use force.
And Mr. Chairman, we do have, I believe, some police officers that will be online to
perhaps address that question.
So far, we have one.
A police officer.
Yeah, but they, you will recall, you will recall one of your questions, Senator French, last time around in the G draft, one, two, and three were ors, and it has been changed in this draft to and. So we questioned the or, and Mr. Guarnelli read them as ands and believed that they were ands, but the drafter had or. So that has been corrected here. So now, at this point, there's a, I had that question too, what is or in the vicinity? And we did talk about that a little bit, and you know, if the crime can, if crime occurs in your apartment dwelling A, or the people in dwelling unit B and C in the vicinity, and there has to be some, I think the intent is there has to be some immediacy, I mean, not just in the same block, but in the there has to be a reasonable belief that they were in the vicinity where they could have maybe provided some kind of material information relating to the crime. Is that correct?
That's absolutely correct, Mr. Chairman. And if I might just point out one other thing in response to Senator French's question about force. There's a provision on line 16 about that temporary detention is necessary to protect a crime victim from imminent harm. I mean, that clause comes directly from a court of appeals case in Alaska, where the police pulled over a vehicle because they believed that the victim of the crime was in that car. That, you know, she'd been seen, you know, leaving a scene, appeared intoxicated, appeared to be maybe fleeing from the police. But the Court of Appeals gave the officers the authority, recognized the authority of the officers to temporarily detain even a crime victim to check on that person's welfare. Now, you know, did they use force? Well, the sirens and the lights went on. I mean, most people would consider that, you know, pulled over a car, most people would consider that to be, you know, some at least show of force. But that is something that is recognized currently in Alaska law. And I think, so the police already have the ability to exercise some level of official authority to accomplish these results. And I think it would be, those same concepts, I think, flow through this work graph.
If I can ask a question, Mr. Guarnelli, let's talk about a police officer believes there was a crime committed and believes that these people may be material witnesses, or they may have been participants in some manner or other in the crime. If they believe that they could pose an imminent threat to the police officer in the investigation, they could detain them a little more securely?
Mr. Chairman, there's a large body of case law that allows the police to take reasonable actions for their own protection, and that ordinarily involves what's known as a pat-down or a frisk. And it's a very cursory check of the you know, outside the person's garments for any hard objects that might potentially be a weapon. And that is something that the police would be able to do.
Is a little lower level than that.
Mr. Chairman, I would think that unless the police have some reason to be in fear of this person, or in fear of even a suspect of a crime, that they would ordinarily not just pat down someone as a matter of course. But they would do so if they have some reason to believe, if there are furtive movements, that sort of thing, and that already exists in the law all across the country.
So, if they suspect that this person is a member of a gang that was involved in some kind of gang warfare, they may have legal authority to even detain them more forcibly than this bill actually allows.
Mr. Chairman, this bill doesn't directly address the level of force.
Right.
I think what was intended was that the reasonableness of the force be dependent on the circumstances, and that is going to be very much a case-by-case, fact-specific circumstance.
Okay. One other question. I know we didn't went through it before, but just for the record, describe for us what an exigent circumstance might be.
Mr. Chairman, and that phrase appears on line 16, the end of line 16, and I know there was some discussion of it during the last hearing. Exigent circumstances is some level that may not rise to an emergency, but there's some reason for taking action now rather than waiting. And what our Supreme Court in reviewing this, and the language in subsection A comes from, described it the last week in the testimony, is the American Law Institute Model Code of Prearrangement Procedure, and that's been quoted with approval by both our Supreme Court and our Court of Appeals. And you know, our Supreme Court specifically noted, you know, what is required are exigent circumstances. The Model Act gives examples of those as obtain or verify the identification, obtain an account of the crime, and then our Court of Appeals also, you know, I believe included the protect a crime victim from imminent harm. Other exigent circumstances are would be those that require that the police take some action now rather than waiting. And one example might be collection of evidence. A witness to a crime may have evidence of that crime, you know, on them in their possession. They may not even be aware of it. If they were very close to the commission of a crime, there may be blood spatters. There may be gunshot residue on crimes against persons, or for felony level property crimes. If they were in the vicinity, they may have been handed something by the suspect. They may be in possession of stolen property that they may not even realize that they have. They may be in possession of something that was handed off to them or left in their custody by the person who took it. So that would be another. In other words, it's necessary to take some action now before the evidence dissipates, disappears, is washed from clothing, that sort of thing. They need to do it now rather than wait. I think that's probably the best explanation.
Thank you. Is there further objection? I'll remove my objection to the CS at this point. Is there further objection to the CS? Hearing none, CS / India is adopted as our working document. Chair would entertain a motion to change on line 28, AS 1161-195 to read AS 11.61.190.
So moved.
Senator Huggins has moved. Is there objection? Hearing none, the amendment number one is adopted.
Mr. Chairman, I'm compelled to ask, do you sleep with these law books?
No, but occasionally I try to read the bills before they get here, and so that I don't get too lost. But that was just one that I happened to probably stumble across as much as anything else. But we have now public testimony, Mr. Monaghan from Anchorage. Mr. Monaghan, are you online?
Yes, I am, Mr. Chair.
If you, sir, will identify yourself for the record. We're eager to hear your testimony this morning, sir.
Okay, my name is Walt Monaghan. I'm the Anchorage Police Chief. And one, I do appreciate the opportunity to testify on this. I've been listening for the entire conversation. And perhaps let me begin by saying I obviously support the bill as it's currently written. And I appreciate everybody's effort in trying to make this as concise as possible. Let me address a couple of concerns that perhaps may satisfy some of the questions I've been listening to. But the idea, for example, if there's a lot of witnesses and a mother was passing through with her child and may or may not be involved or whatnot, if in fact we can find, if she produces some identification, then there would be no real need to be suspicious of that identification. She looks like she's just being in the wrong place at the wrong time kind of thing, but still may have some information for me. And so there wouldn't be a need to necessarily go full extent in fingerprinting her or her child or anything like that. One of the reasons why I think that is kind of pertinent is that some of you may recall a case in regards to a homicide that happened here in Anchorage that was outside of a VFW. And we, at one time, we were told that there may have been as many as 50, that's 50 witnesses, that were out in the parking lot when the shooting occurred. And to this date, almost 4 years ago, we still don't have any clue on who the individuals were in the parking lot, and this homicide remains unsolved. So it's that's kind of some of the frustration, as well as, you know, the community wanting to have some kind of resolution to these kind of crimes. The other concern I heard was that in regards to maybe somebody didn't see the shooting but may have a little peace. Perhaps most of you would remember a case that happened back in the early 80s here in Anchorage. It was a Charles Meach, where he had basically shot and killed four teenagers in Russian Jack Park. I happened to be on that case, and how that case was solved was that one of the witnesses who didn't see the shooting, but when the officers arrived at the scene, said, "I saw a brown van driving fast out of here." And one of the responding officers intercepted a brown van, made a stop on it, checked who it was, didn't seem like they were involved, and cut them loose. Well, as all the other clues ran dry, we went back and dug up all those other kind of ancillary kind of contacts to include the driver of the brown van. And in subsequent interview of the brown van driver, he advised he was walking through the park. He actually spotted a bicycle in the bushes, and he said, "I shouldn't tell you this, but I was thinking about stealing it." And then he heard shots that scared him. He jumped in his van and drove away. Well, he knew his bicycles, and as he described it, we found that Anchorage, there was only one dealer that had those bicycles that sold them. And that particular model, because it was so unique, there was only 12 of those particular bicycles sold. And we tracked, and the dealer happened to have the records for all of the bikes. And we ran all 12 people, and we found Mr. Charles Meach at API. So even though no one actually saw the kids being shot, it is much as luck as persistence that sometimes cracks our case. So if that, in a way, addresses the concern about not necessarily being the eyewitness, but you may have a little piece of the puzzle that helps us put this thing together, I just wanted to address that.
Okay. Any questions for Mr. Monaghan? Senator French?
Good morning, Chief Monaghan. It's nice to hear your voice here in Juneau. It's Hollis French. My question is going back to the one I posed to Mr. Guinelli, and that is the level of force that you would authorize your officers to use, or this bill would authorize your officers to use, to stop and detain witnesses. Maybe you could speak a little bit about that and sort of give me some guidelines, or give the committee some guidelines about, you know, where you think your officers would be authorized to, for example, put someone in a police car, put handcuffs on them, what steps you will envision taking to get compliance with this law.
Well, candidly, I mean, these situations, especially if someone was shot and is down, then everybody in the immediate area who is obviously very affected by that. And when we get there, when we get respond and arrive on the scene, it's very chaotic. It's so the officers basically have to kind of sort out what transpired. I mean, that often, when the cases are viewed later or reviewed or presented in court, it seems like there's a logical kind of thing. But in the beginning, it's chaos. The responding officers don't know who's the good guy, who's the bad guy. They have to actually sort out and find out, what's your role in this? Where are you? And we do the pat down because we don't know if the shooter is still there and armed and standing in the crowd with everybody else. So we do have to stabilize and contain the scene for the protection of everyone that's involved, including the officers. And many times what will happen is we separate witnesses or separate individuals. We don't know if they're witnesses or suspects yet. And we put them in individual cars. Sometimes we cuff them until we can find out what transpired, who is what and where and what their roles were. And that is just a normal course of action. Most people are very, very compliant with that, and they understand that. And the officers are fairly good about explaining that afterwards. To answer your question, will we walk into a scene and immediately know what's going on? No, we won't. It'll take a few minutes. It'll take some effort on the officers to try to calm down the emotional level at the of all the participants in there and try to figure out what transpired and who is what role. And normally, like I said, everything happens fairly quietly. But there are a few that will be maybe adamant or try to resist or try to run. And when that happens, especially on a shooting scene, that's going to activate our prey drive, if you will, and we're going to wonder, why is this individual trying to run from a shooting scene? And I think, again, a reasonable person statute or standard would be applicable here. We want to find out, why are you running? And so we, as a matter of course, we just try to stabilize. Does that mean we throw people down on the ground or whatnot? No, we don't. We don't want to mistreat anybody, to include suspects, especially if we find out that we're talking to witnesses, and because we want their information, we want their cooperation, and you don't do that by, first off, threatening them. Yeah, that's kind of a sideways answer to you, Hollis. I don't know if that helps you out or not.
Any other questions? Senator Huggins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Chief Monaghan, Charlie Huggins here.
Howdy, sir.
Howdy. You know, my concern is if you take the police chief in Palmer, Wasilla, Houston, Alaska, and Alaska State Troopers, and how they issue guidance to their personnel based on a relatively far-reaching concept. Your thoughts?
In what they would do?
Yeah.
Probably the same that we would do. In fact, the idea is that our officers, one, must be respectful, and they, two, must be professional. And we're trying to invoke cooperation and rapport with everybody at the scene. And if you come on like gangbusters, if you start throwing your weight around as a police officer and try to intimidate people into bullying them, that is a situation that is doomed for failure as far as a successful investigation. So I think that they, like us, will try to calmly and quickly stabilize the scene, sort out who's who, and then try to seek out that information that will help us resolve it.
Okay.
Is that the answer that you...
No, that's good. No, that's fine. Thank you very much.
Okay.
Other questions? Thank you, Mr. Monaghan, for being with us this morning.
Thank you.
You bet. Anybody else that wants to testify on this bill this morning? Seeing none, anybody else online? No? We'll close public testimony on the bill. The bill now is open for discussion among the members. I think the bill is one where it appears that we're taking it in the most serious of circumstances and giving some additional powers for detainment under some very carefully crafted requirements here. From that standpoint, I'm satisfied that it probably is ready to move on to the next committee of referral. Is there another committee after this one?
I don't think so. This is it.
Finance?
This goes to finance, yes.
This goes to finance. And, you know, I believe this is one of those where we do have to be very careful, and I think we've done our due diligence in trying to make sure that we're not treading into the constitutional protections that people have in society. It's a tough balance. I understand that we don't always live in a gentle society, and so I'm satisfied with this bill at this point in time. Will of the committee on this bill?
Mr. Chair, if I might.
Senator Huggins?
This is one of those that, I mean, quite frankly, if I lived in Anchorage, I'd be very supportive of based on the circumstances. I'm a little more reluctant based on Mat-Su. And I guess I would be less than candid if I didn't say that sunset sorts of provisions sort of popped in my head at a point in time. And I'm not saying we need to do that, but it hasn't disappeared yet, for lack of a better term. Just review what the implications are after a number of years. And I don't know the sponsor's feeling on that, where he thought about it or not.
Mr. Chairman, obviously any legislation can be changed by any legislature at any time. So I guess I hadn't thought about and don't see the need for a specific sunset in that. If it seems abusive, I would guess that next year's legislature or the one following would certainly repeal or adjust.
Yeah. Well, I'm not going to propose a sunset at this point in time. It's just one of those things. I'd be less candid if I didn't say that it kind of cropped up in my mind.
Chairman?
I agree. Go ahead, Senator French.
Thank you. I guess I still have some concerns. The concerns I have center around the taking of photographs, which I agree is a useful police tool, and we should employ that as much as possible. But the bill as it's written right now would make it a crime if, you know, a person who was simply in a hurry for whatever reason, for whatever lawful reason, either to rejoin their children somewhere or to get home to cook dinner or to go to the insurance agent or whatever it is that makes you in a hurry, you could be charged with a crime for hurrying away from a scene that you know nothing about and going about your lawful way, and don't let yourself be photographed. The fingerprint portion I have some greater support for, because it's narrowly crafted to the most serious of crimes, and I think people in my community would support, you know, slowing people down when there's been a shooting or a murder or even an attempted murder. But the way it's written right now, any misdemeanor assault or any you know, burglary, which in a mall parking lot could mean smashing the window of a car and reaching in and grabbing a purse, which happens probably on a daily basis in Anchorage. That's a felony property crime. It's theft of over $500. I have concerns about making that a crime to not be photographed at that crime scene.
No, I understand that. I do understand that that the Section A does apply to any particular crime, but it has to be, does not apply to any particular crime. It has to be against a person, as I understand it, for a crime against a person or a felony property crime. Is that correct, Mr. Quinelli?
It is correct, Mr. Chairman. Those are the two qualifiers, and that the person may have information of material A.
Right.
And I guess I.
But the first part is it has to be for a more serious crime before they can do that.
And I think that, and I'm not certain that Senator French intended to characterize it this way, but it's not simply a matter of somebody just hurrying on their way. This is someone, you know, without knowing that they're needed for the investigation. I mean, this is someone who, you know, the officers have contacted. You know, could you wait just a minute? I need to get some information from you. In other words, the officers have already contacted them. And I think that, you know, the fact of the matter is, you're in public, you're pictures are subject to be taken at any time. And this requires that the police basically have a digital camera, you know, with them. And I think that if they're going to be doing that, they can't unreasonably detain people. They've got to be able to do it right there at the scene. And the digital cameras are often carried and often carried concealed.
I carry mine.
And, Mr. Chairman, I would point out, of course, all the surveillance cameras that are on in the malls and various businesses at this point. We're probably photographed a great deal more than we realize.
And again, I think the biggest thing here is I think every one of us respect most of the police officers that are out there. Occasionally you get a bad apple that pushes it a little bit too far and can, you know, as I understand it, that's the person that's that also is a prosecutor's nightmare. And the defense attorneys know very well how to handle a situation where a police officer has gone beyond what is reasonable, I think, in these kinds of things as well. But I would hope that, I see this common sense behind this. I hope that it's used, if it goes all the way through and gets passed, I hope it's used wisely and it's used judiciously and it's used for the purpose of putting away. And Senator Terrio told me I can't use the word scumbags anymore, so I won't describe those people that way. But
unless you're defending your castle, perhaps.
Yes, correct. So,
well, Mr. Chairman, let me
ahead,
just thank you. Again, I think the people in my community would support giving the police the authority to detain someone to take fingerprints, if necessary, using a certain amount of force in a murder or attempted murder or drive-by shooting. And I guess I think they would support making it a crime to not comply with that, given the seriousness of the offense. But I think that while photographs are frequently taken, chances are there will have been a photograph taken to slow down a law-abiding citizen and force them to have their photograph taken for a $500 theft and to make it a crime for them not to comply, I think is going further than I'm comfortable going. So I'm going to propose an amendment, and that amendment would be on page 3, line 8. And that would be to delete the words photographs or to delete those two words from line 8 on page 3, and that would have the effect of reducing the availability of the Class B misdemeanor to only those situations where a person didn't comply with the taking of fingerprints, which, as we know from having reviewed the bill, only applies to those attempted murder crimes, or misconduct involving weapon in the first degree. So that's my proposal, to focus this narrowly on the most serious crimes. We're giving the police the authority to take photographs. They simply won't be able to charge you with a crime if you don't comply. And I think if the cameras are handy in the pockets of all police officers, they'll be able to pull that off. But if the camera is back in the trunk of that car that's 100 yards away or even 20 yards away, and a citizen just has a pressing need to leave the scene, a law-abiding citizen, then I guess I'm going to tip the balance in favor of the citizen. So that's my motion and my amendment.
Could you restate your motion, yes, please.
Thank you. On page 3, line 8, I would delete the words photographs or, so that the line would now read, a person who refuses or resists the taking of fingerprints under this section commits Class B misdemeanor, which is punishable as provided in 1255, except that the case sentence of imprisonment imposed may not exceed 10 days. So it would just eliminate the photograph portion of the line.
Okay, let me ask you a question, Mr. Guinelli. A peace officer who has temporarily detained a person under A of this section, at this point, the police officer has had to determine that temporary detention of the person is reasonably necessary to obtain or verify the identification of the person detained account of the crime to protect the crime victim from innocent harm or other exigent circumstances. So there has to be some reasonable necessity in that police officer's mind to detain this person first, and then he can ask to take the photograph after he has gone through the steps in Section A. Am I correct?
That is correct, Mr. Chairman. And if I might, you know, I had a specific discussion with Senator Bundy's staff yesterday about the criminal provision. And the reason it's in there is related to Senator French's concern about use of force. In other words, what can the police do to accomplish you know, what the authority that this this bill allows them to. And so the idea is you may get some people who resist fingerprints or, you know, resist photographs, but the officer, in what Chief Monaghan indicated, you know, trying to get their cooperation and not being overbearing, is going to say, you know, why don't you make it easy on yourself? You know, I have the authority to take you into custody if you don't allow me to do this. It's going to be really easy. I've got the camera right here in my pocket. Let me just snap a picture. It's going to be real easy. And I think that by having that provision in there that allows the police to you know, advise them of the consequences will make the situations far, far fewer where they have to use any force at all. And it was for that specific reason that this provision was included in there. I mean, we had that specific discussion. I mean, this will avoid the necessity of using force, of grabbing people, that sort of thing. So that was the reason, and that's my comment.
If someone is put in this temporary detention to obtain to verify the identification of the person, under normal circumstances, if the police officer wants to know, okay, I need to give some proof of identification, he can ask them if they have a government-issued identification card of some kind, driver's license or identification card, in A3. Am I correct? He can already ask for that.
Correct.
And he says, I'm temporarily detaining you for the purpose of determining who you are. Is that correct?
That's correct.
So now, do you have some identification? No, I don't have any on me. Then he says, okay, I want to take your picture. So are you taking the picture because the person has no other form of reasonable identification? Have we come to that point in the conversation?
Mr. Chairman, I would think that would probably be the most common scenario where the police officer would want to take a picture. In other words, the person has not been able to show photographic identification. There may be those, as Chief Monaghan indicates, where he's got some suspicion whether the ID is valid, and it is not one of the limited murder, attempted murder, etc., where they can take fingerprints, and so he's going to say, okay, let me snap your photo.
This is a person already under this temporary detention that we're talking about.
Correct.
Before they can take the picture.
Correct. That's correct. The conditions in A have to have been met, have to have been satisfied.
So it isn't like, you know, if someone has to stick around to take their picture if they haven't been temporarily detained.
That's correct.
And I think that's kind of what I'm trying to get at, is that someone who the police officer has already determined could be a material witness that he hasn't been otherwise able to identify, or that he needs some other clarification to be able to identify. And that's kind of, so it isn't just someone hurrying to get to their PTA meeting. It's someone who he believes is going to be a material witness already, or a participant, perhaps.
I think you've characterized it perfectly.
Okay. Senator Guess.
Senator Shekins, it doesn't say if the person doesn't have identification. And it doesn't say if they think it's faulty. So I could show them my ID. They could take all the information. And they still might detain me to take my photograph, and then it's a Class B misdemeanor if I say, look, you know,
I have a harder
my kid's on the street outside the daycare, and I got to pick them up, and you already have my identification if I leave. So
I have a harder time with the words online aid over there or resist than I do of photographs. But you know, what is resist taking the picture? I mean, if I was going to carry something to that respect, what does resist mean? I don't want my picture taken. Am I resisting? Am I subject now to a misdemeanor, or I eventually allow it? I do have. But go ahead. I didn't mean to interrupt you.
No, I just want to clarify for the record, although those might be the cases we're talking about, that's not how the bill reads.
But it does, in my mind, it is someone who has been put under temporary detention.
Mr. Chairman, I'd go back to line 5, or 4 and 5, the officer has reasonable suspicion. Again, the judgment that comes in, I mean, you can't just be, Gestapo just can't stop yeah. you and say, show me your papers. There has to be reasonable
right.
suspicion, and then all the other subordinate things apply.
But again, to me, it's someone who has been said, you, sir, are under temporary detention. Do not leave. Not like the old Class B movie where the cop comes in and says, all right, somebody got killed here and nobody leave the building till I find out who did it. You know, this is kind of, you have been placed under a temporary detention. I imagine they have to have been told that. They know they're there. They can't leave until they're released.
That's correct.
Is that correct?
That's correct. But the notion of reasonableness and the duration of the detention, you know, is found in all the case law, and that's going to apply regardless. I mean, it's got to be for the purpose that the person is detained. I mean, you can't be just detained just to make them wait around.
Right,
if the purpose is to obtain identification, once you've obtained identification,
let them go.
If the purpose is to find out, you know, what they saw, as soon as they tell you what they saw, and if you then need identification because they have something important to say, find that out and let them go.
Right. Mr. Chairman.
And so I guess I don't have as much fear of it, Senator French, when I know that they've already been placed in temporary detention, and I understand your concern, but go ahead, Senator French.
Well, 2 points. There's no Miranda warnings for someone who's under temporary detention. There's no set of words that command the sort of notify you of your rights and
right.
what applies and what doesn't apply in temporary detention. It's a fluid, fast-moving situation, and officers are going to interpret it as necessary to protect themselves and to protect the public, which we want them to be able to do. But it's not as if they walk in and say, okay, you, I have a reasonable suspicion to believe, you know, and read them their rights. That's not going to happen. So it's going to be a fluid situation. But more importantly, if we really want to let people go once they've shown government ID, then we need to write that into the bill. But it's not written into the bill, as Senator Guess has pointed out. And I just know as sure as daylight we're going to come upon a situation in a mall setting, because this is what we're getting at, our crimes that happen when there's lots of witnesses and people flee like rats, and it's very frustrating for the police, and I recognize that. But we're gonna grab someone who doesn't fit the mold of the ordinary citizen, but who is lawfully going about their business, who is going to be for whatever reason not wanting to have their photograph taken, and we're going to wind up charging them with a crime,
and I
have reservations.
Senator French's amendment, which would be amendment number 2, is to remove from line 8 on page 2 the words photographs or. I object. Call the roll.
Senator Huggins?
No.
Senator Guess?
Yes.
Senator French?
Yes.
Chair Seacon?
No. Amendment fails. Pass on a 2-2 vote. The bill is before you. Is there a will of the committee? You want to move?
Yeah, I would move that.
Okay. We want to find out. Mr. Chairman, I move that CS for Senate Bill 206, version India, be moved from committee with attached physical note and individual comments.
As amended.
As amended.
All right. Is there objection? Hearing none, this bill is moved to its next committee of referral. We'll take about a 3-minute recess. We're back on the record. Next on our schedule this morning is Senate Bill 306, and Senator Bundy.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. For the record, Con Bundy, Senate District P. Senate Bill 306 is a bill that addresses unemployment insurance avoidance schemes that can be brought about by unscrupulous employers. This type of activity occurs when one business buys out another with a lower unemployment insurance rate and then basically transfers what should be a higher employees with a higher unemployment insurance rate into the lower. I think it's not too broad to say defrauding the system. I would call the committee's attention to a letter from the U.S. Department of Labor indicating that we were out of compliance with federal regulations and that it's important that we become in compliance. And that is the essence of the bill. If we were not to become in compliance, it's $103.9 million in additional taxes to employers, and the state would lose $30.8 million for administrative and operational programs for the UI program. Mr. Chairman, it is a preventative bill. I know of no specific instances of a company, excuse me, basically using this the unemployment system fraudulently. It is a concern, as I pointed out, from the federal government. The Department of our State Department of Labor may be able to give you specific instances of attempted fraud. But with that, I think that's the essence of the bill. Mr. Chairman.
Questions for the sponsor? Senator Guess.
Thank you. I agree with the intent of the bill. I just had some questions on trying to understand it. Section 1, and I'll just tell you my perspective is just kind of coming from the small business perspective versus Monpa, I guess, corner grocery store versus Monpa Anadarko, which I'm not really worried about. So what if someone doesn't, either because they don't know or, you know, notify the department of a business change? What happens in that situation? I don't have the rest of the statute with me. That's just Section 1. I mean, it makes perfect sense when someone buys a business and they need to tell, but what if they don't, not because they're purposefully not?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, do you have an answer, Jane, or do we need to talk to Department of Labor? Because I don't know what the enforcement is.
For the record, this is Jane Albert, staff to Senator Bundy. I'm just going to make a guess that if this legislation passes, there probably through regulation would be some kind of a notification process for businesses notifying them that they, if they were to be transferring or purchasing another business, that they would be required by law to notify the Department of Labor. However, I would feel more comfortable if the Department of Labor folks supported me in that statement.
I will ask them, but it appears to me that as long as you're not dumping, you have no concern. This, you have to knowingly have intended to deceive to obtain a more favorable unemployment insurance rate. Otherwise, the rest of the statute's pretty much the same. Am I correct in nodding heads back there from the department? Mm-hmm. Yes, that seems, I have three people nodding. I have hit a new high, Miss Senator Bundy.
And Mr. Chairman, if I might, on page 2, yes. Beginning of line 8, you know, there are some provisos here.
Yeah.
One is the most important, that primarily for the purpose of obtaining a more favorable rate.
And it has to be in violation of 42 U.S.C. 503K, mm-hmm. Dumping Prevention Act of 2004, as I understand this bill. Who we got from the Department of Labor who would like to prove me right or wrong this morning?
For the record, my name is Paula Scavera. I am the Special Assistant to the Commissioner of the Alaska Department of Labor. With me is the Director, Tom Nelson, who's the Director of Unemployment Security Division, and Pat Shire, who's the Deputy Director and the Chief of Tax. I think this is a tax question, so I'm going to hand it over to Mr. Shire.
Pat? Welcome to Judiciary Committee. If you'll just, for the record,
thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Pat Shire. I'm the Acting Deputy Director for the Employment Security Division, Department of Labor and Workforce Development. And I can confirm that this law is intended to cease or stop or discourage that activity known as willful misrepresentation for the purpose of obtaining a lower rate. There are all kinds of reasons that an employer would want to notify us that there's been a change in ownership, not the least of which being collections, responsibility for filing the reports. There is currently a minor penalty under 2320, 495, and 500 for failure to comply. This complies with the federal intent that there be more meaningful penalties for the specific purpose of misleading the department in order to fraudulently obtain an artificially low rate.
And the minor penalty, there's nothing that changes that here as far as the current statute is concerned.
Mr. Chairman, no.
Other questions, Senator Guest?
Well, I'll go back to my original question. We got off on another section, that would be Section 3 versus Section 1.
I just thought from the general purpose standpoint, this was meant to deter fraud.
And I don't disagree. It's just in that we have this little section that, although in that article, and I'm trying to figure out where it fits on the experience rating, says you got to, you know, notify. It's interesting. It doesn't say when a person buys a business. It says when one employing unit buys another one. So I'm not sure what happens when a person who's not an employing unit buys a business and what they're supposed to do in those situations. But I just wanted, you know, one business buys another business, they have to notify. This doesn't seem to have anything to do with this section, and I don't mind the section. I was just wondering what happens when that employing unit doesn't notify the department. And the answer is, I still didn't, is that the fines and the regulations?
Maybe we should start one area there to help me. What is an employing unit?
Mr. Chairman, an employing unit is defined as a person or an organization in statute that has working for it for more than a certain number of days consecutively in a quarter. It's a definition that we've been using for many, many years, since the 40s, really. And I'm sorry that I don't have an actual copy of it here.
Right. Is a self-employed person with no other employees an employing unit?
Mr. Chairman, no.
So they have to have employed someone other than the owner or proprietor of the business?
The implication is that there is service performed by one person for the benefit of another.
Okay.
That's wrapped up in the definition of an employing unit.
So let's take a look at Senator Guest and her husband being involved in their home business, mom and pop corner business. Are they an employee unit if they're the only two people that are involved in the business?
Mr. Chairman, no. They would not be considered as long as the spouse and the other spouse are the only two individuals performing service for the benefit of the partnership. Entity is an important consideration. There are a number of different entities. If they were a corporation, they might be an employing unit.
The corporation might be.
Right.
And depending on even the type of corporation, whether it's an S or a C.
That's correct.
So then employing unit, we don't use here the universal person, because person would require everyone, including self-employed, to report a change in the business ownership.
That's correct.
That's why my question. Does it yours, Sam? Gretchen?
I just had a simple question.
I know, but I'm just, you raised a couple in my mind as you asked that.
That, you know, when someone buys, you know, there's a lot of mergers and acquisitions, a lot of mergers of small businesses. Someone decides to buy someone else's business, and they're both small little businesses. And I just, you know, just wondered how those businesses know that they need to notify, and what are the penalties for not notifying in that situation?
Through the chair, Senator Gist, I can help you with that. Of course, this whole section 20 through 20 has been in effect for some years prior to statehood, even. Mm-hmm. And under 2320.105 and the Alaska Administrative Code, Title 8, Section 85, we describe what the duties of the employer are regarding notifying the department that they've entered into an employer-employee relationship and that they have responsibilities. We run into this all the time, and when an employer fails to notify us that they've decided to enter the realm of productive commerce in the state of Alaska, improving our local economy, we are glad to have them, and we do not penalize them. This is designed to codify in law, specifically, rather than just regulation, that there is that obligation. And if you look at this, I don't see in this section 293 any penalty associated with failure to report. As we become aware of them, we certainly do all we can to help that employer comply, but to my knowledge, we have never penalized an employer for failure to step forward and tell us.
Okay. Thank you. That was my first question.
Good. Next question.
Section 3, which is
and
the...
Pat, you can just answer directly to the senator in this committee.
Section 3, which is the meat of the bill. A, which everything kind of refers back to A in the rest of the bill. Can you just walk me through, there's two situations that are discussed in A. And I just want to make sure that I understand them, because they're both, when you violate A, I mean, we have some new substantial penalties, including felonies, mm-hmm. in here. So can you walk through one and two on A?
Senator Gist, certainly. First of all, it's important to note that on line 16 and 17, the statement, the following standards apply regarding assignment of rates in transfers of experience. And this is really the heart of the matter, that this is the purpose we are attempting to, with laser accuracy, describe. And if an employer transfers, as in Section 1, we're prescribing that if I walk in as an employer with a lousy rate because I lay people off a lot, and I decide that I don't want to pay a high rate next year, and I decide to buy the local bakery that has a very, very stable employment history and has a very, very low rate, that I have to take my high rate with me. I cannot escape it by simply buying another business and transferring my payroll to it. So when it talks the unemployment experience attributed to the transferred trade, business, or workforce, line 23, is transferred to the employer to whom that trade, business, or workforce is transferred, and then they are recalculated based on the existing regulation that we have regarding whether it was substantially all the business, substantially all the employees that were transferred. Was this a transfer we would examine simply to avoid a rate, or was there a bona fide business reason why these two combined? And that's for an existing employer. Number two is describing if a person is not an employer at the time the person acquires that other business, and governs how that rate will be determined for that individual.
Okay.
In other words, they would not start over as a brand new employer with an average rate. They would also inherit some of the rating that's going on at the current time.
So let's go back to number one.
Okay.
I'm a business and I'm going to buy another business. Line 20, at the time of transfer, there's substantially common ownership, management, or control of the two employers. And that's why I guess I got confused. I decide to buy the business down the street and we merge, or is it that I have to have ownership of both the businesses and I'm merging them together?
Senator, it would be more like I'm a proprietorship with a lousy unemployment rate and I want to escape it, so I incorporate.
Well, that's actually not what it's about.
Because
I mean, that's the reason for the bill,
right.
But what this says is it doesn't matter. I mean, so is it... is it, do I have to have, own, is, does there have to be substantial common ownership between the two employers, and then I'm merging those businesses together, or is it the fact that I'm buying another business, and when I merge those together, it has to be recalculated? And that's why, it, at the time of transfer, there's substantially common ownership confused me on what situation are we talking about.
Senator Gist, I said corrected. You're exactly right. The common ownership portion that you mentioned, at the time of the transfer, there is substantially common ownership, is the language that the federal government required in order to allow states to identify who was really at the root of the transfer and helping us determine the purpose for the transfer. If it was an existing business buying another business, and at the end of the day, the ownership of that business was substantially the same as the ownership before we started the transaction in the moving party, so to speak, that will affect how we calculate the rate. If there is a combination of two different employers, for example, two corporations, for example, and there's a change in the board and maybe the ownership is not substantially the same as before, that gives us the clue and the employer the ability to point at us and say, see, this was not for just rate avoidance. We really did have a significant change in operation here, and that would be guiding for us in trying to determine if it was a transfer only for escaping a rate or not.
Okay. So this is a flag, because it makes logical sense. The rates of both employers are recalculated and made effective immediately upon the date. I mean, I'm not sure how you violate this section, and all everything else comes back to this section. So, I mean, this just seems as if this is how you deal with recalculation when you have, I'm a part owner over here, and I'm a part owner over here, and we decide to merge these two companies. But when I merge those two companies, you recalculate the rate.
Correct. We do that today. You're right.
So I'm not in violation of any, I mean, I'm not sure what the violation is in number one, that we're then making a criminal action in that section. So I guess it goes back to, unless you're doing number, for the purposes of number one, goes back to obtaining more favorable rates or in violation of. Am I correct?
Correct, Senator.
Okay. So on number two, I decide to go out and buy a business, or I buy a business that I have nothing to do with. I'm a business and I go and I acquire another business. May not be transferred to that person if the commissioner finds in order to obtain. I guess my question is, why all of a sudden do we have the commissioner in number two and not in number one? Why doesn't it go back to D1 and D4 only? And how is the commissioner going to determine that it was to obtain a lower rate?
Senator Guest, in the number one, we're talking about an employer, which is somebody who has certain rights and obligations under 2320. In number two, we're talking in a person who is not an employer, and until they make that acquisition, they don't have any rights or responsibilities under the Act. Now, if someone in anticipating trying to obtain a lower rate sells a business, ceases business for a brief period of time, they are no longer an employer, they're a person. And any other employer that would close their business for a period of time and reopen it, mm-hmm. we would reopen the old account. We would examine their rate history, and when their new account opened, they would enjoy the rate that they previously had, and it would become part of their rate history. In this case, if a person closes a business for a period of time and then seeks to walk out as a person and purchase another business, this allows us to examine that person and make sure that they are assigned the proper rate. In other words, we could look at it and say, you closed your old business, and you waited for a quarter, and then you bought this other business, and it says in here, in verse 29, if the commissioner finds that the person acquired the trade business or workforce in order to obtain a lower rate, we can reach back and assign the rate from the prior business. There are different classes of individuals when they come under this statute. One is an employer walking in the door, and the other one is a person who is not currently an employer. Now, as far as the language that says the commissioner, I'd be unable to answer that specifically without looking a little further or consulting our technical unit. This is based on the federal guidelines that we receive from the USDOL.
And I know they write such good federal guidelines that it's so clear. Okay, back to number one. My apologies, Ms. Chair. I just want to make sure I understand this. Number one, though, is I have to have a substantial ownership in both businesses. Number two is a person. What if I'm just an employer buying another business? Which one do I fall under, one or two?
Under number one, Senator.
Okay. I guess it was just odd that the violation sections don't go back to D, 1, and 4. They go back to these. And I think that's where I was caught up. I know that it's part of A, but then we get into how you're recalculating UI, and you're saying that the violations go back to A, and that's just kind of a confusing way to read the bill to understand what, I mean, these are felonies back here, and it's, and then I go to this recalculation, and I'm like, what did you break in there? And then you have to go back up to 1 and 4 and say, you know, I did something for these reasons, but then you have a commissioner making a determination that then could lead into a felony. And that's just my confusion. I mean, it's, I'm not understanding why it's written the way it's written.
It appears to me they're fraudulent acts under 1 or 4.
But, Mr. Chair, wouldn't we want, shouldn't 1 and 2 under A be part of the system regardless if they're fraudulent or not? This is how you want to recalculate rates. Everyone knows if you're going into it, you're going to recalculate rates either in 1 or 2, regardless of what the purpose is. I mean, that's...
Well, yeah, you would, but on D, 2 and 3... These are not fraudulent acts. There's an inequity that exists, or it's contrary to public interest of some kind, but it doesn't. Where 1 and 4 are for the primary purpose of obtaining a more favorable rate, or to be in violation of the Anti-Dumping Protection Act, which appear to be, to me, be fraudulent acts. Well, the other two might not have any fraud involved. It's just that the commissioner has determined it's inequitable or not. It's contrary to public purpose. There was no intent. There was no knowing intent for someone to do that. It just happened, and it.
Mr. Chairman, intent and knowing, they're very high standards,
right.
And they're very, very difficult to prove. And again, we're not aware that this is a rampant problem in the state of Alaska. The main reason for us to be here is because the federal government has said if you fail to adopt regulations that or laws that provide for quote-unquote meaningful penalties, then Alaska employers will lose $103 million of tax credits, and the department itself will lose $30 million of operating funds.
Well, that's the issue for finance, I guess. I think, yeah, we have more of a problem with people not actually paying UI than probably this situation. It's just, you know, you're deciding to make some fairly serious crimes out of something, regardless of the reason behind them. So I'll just ask one more question. And if this is the way it's written, it's just, it's very unclear. And 1 and 2 don't seem to be, except for the commissioner finding that the person did it to obtain a lower rate, I don't see the crime in them, and I don't see how it just doesn't necessarily flow back up to 1 and 4 very well. But I'll let that go and just ask on the criminals parts of the section, obtaining unemployment contributions rate by deception, which all goes back to B and C, which all goes back to A. a person commits the crime, it's a business that commits the crime, and a business can't be charged with Class B felony. So in those situations, who is?
Senator, would you restate that, please?
In Section 4 of the bill, when it talks about right. the new criminal section, and a person commits the crime of obtaining unemployment contribution rate by deception, a business can't get a felony. A person has to be charged with a felony. Is there case law, or who in the business actually is responsible and would be charged with a felony in these situations if they were in violation of A, which is really of D, knowingly?
Senator, it's the individual who has the duty to pay, and that there's a large body of case law tested all the way through the Supreme Court repeatedly. As you can imagine, whenever we try to apply some of the provisions of 2320, particularly when it comes to paying a large bill, there doesn't seem to be anybody standing in the room. And when it comes to the definition of person and employer in those cases, it's well defined as the individual has the duty to pay.
To pay. Okay. Great. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
We've come to the magic hour on this bill. We will carry it over until tomorrow morning, first thing. Tomorrow after this bill, if you have any amendments or any suggestions on the bill tomorrow morning, we'll look at House Bill 410 and House Bill 326. But we'll carry this bill over to be the first item on our agenda for tomorrow morning. And with that, is there anything else to come before the committee? The Senator?
Point out, obviously, this was a bill by request.
Yes. Is there anything else to come before the committee today? Now it's 10:34 a.m., and we are adjourned.